You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a new study that shows most Americans believe Muslims face more discrimination than Christians, except for white evangelicals. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Big political news today. House Speaker Paul Ryan told President Donald Trump he didn't have the votes to pass legislation to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. House Republican leaders decided to pull the legislation from consideration just a little while ago. Here in Wisconsin, of course, big news, both for the impact it might have had on Wisconsin and for Wisconsin political figure Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House. Sean Johnson joins us now to look at that and other top stories from the past week. He's Capitol Bureau Chief for WPR News. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
So a big deal here. Let's look at Paul Ryan, first of all. I mean, he had this whole saga. Is he going to support Donald Trump during the campaign? We ended up where we are, and now what?
Yeah, and I mean, not to downplay at all, like, the real world consequences of what they're talking about with this. I mean, they were talking about a bill that would have affected dropped coverage for 14 million people in just a year. So, I mean, obviously, there are bigger things at stake than political races.
Sure.
But this is a political story as well. And we have Paul Ryan, the guy who is who's leading this effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, is our guy. He's from Wisconsin. He's been saying over and over again, this is going to happen now. This has been the agenda we've heard for 7 years, and it's done. I mean, he pretty clearly said that Obamacare is the law of the land. Donald Trump said, I'm glad it's behind me, basically, that we're done. We're going to move on to tax reform. So pretty remarkable, failure here for Speaker Ryan in his first big act as Speaker. He hasn't been in this position where he's had to get major legislation through before. Here he was finding himself in that position and failing.
And here in Wisconsin, I mean, everybody from the governor through all levels of government, the whole healthcare system has had this big question mark. What's next? Mm-hmm. So what does this mean for Wisconsin?
It means the status quo for right now, and so we're not all these changes that we are contemplating in terms of what is a Medicaid block grant mean for Wisconsin? What's it going to mean for coverage here? What's going to happen to, lower income residents here? All that kind of goes away. And we go back to talking about what we have now, which is the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And I don't know that there's going to be discussions about tweaking that given what just happened here with this bill.
We'll talk more about this on Central Time in just about a half an hour and take your calls, too. Let's move on to some more state-specific issues, Sean. Yesterday, a public hearing on a package of drunk driving bills, and this is something, speaking of long sagas, we've seen a lot of drunk driving bills introduced over the years. What are we seeing this time around?
I think the big theme that you saw from a couple of these bills that had a hearing this week is that they would increase the minimum sentences for repeat drunk drivers. And so, like, for example, for a fifth or sixth time drunk driver, minimum sentence would go from 6 months to 18 months. So it's not a situation where they're looking at bills that are going to throw the book at somebody who gets their first DUI. Not at all. It's something where they want to increase the minimum penalties for repeat drunk drivers and make a 5-year minimum prison sentence if somebody gets behind the wheel drunk and kills someone. So we don't know what's going to happen with these bills. I mean, bills that crack down on drunk driving in Wisconsin sometimes don't go anywhere. I mean, this is just an issue that people, maybe don't go out and argue forcefully against, but there is this idea that drinking is part of the culture in the state. And bills like this have financial consequences as well. I mean, if you're talking about increasing mandatory minimum sentences, you're going to lock people up for longer, and that has a cost.
I want to give a listen to a clip from this hearing. This is Liz Thorne. Her son Dylan was killed by a drunk driver in 2012. The OWI offender in this case served 1 year in jail with work leave and probation. So this is Liz Thorne.
The whole time we went through this court process, we felt like we were the criminals. We were never the victim. She had all of the rights. And we felt like we had nobody fighting for us or for our son.
She's not the first person to make this case here in Wisconsin. Have we seen changes over the years in our drunk driving laws with that kind of sentiment in mind?
There have been some. They passed, for example, an ignition interlocks bill requiring some offenders to get ignition interlocks on their vehicles. That was back in 2009. That was kind of the big step the Democrats took when they were in power. There's actually a bill that was up this week that would tweak that law to close a loophole with that law. There have been moves in the last couple sessions to increase mandatory minimums. But again, a lot of these bills don't go anywhere. I mean, they kind of languish.
And Republican Jim Ott is attached to, I think, all three of these pieces of legislation.
There is,
you mentioned.
Yeah.
He's been a crusader on these issues.
Right, that's his issue every session.
We're talking to Sean Johnson about some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. Moving on to the newest Marquette Law School poll out Wednesday. Now, we're not watching these as intently as we were, you know, during the big election season, Sean, but a lot here. What stuck out to you most in this new poll?
I think kind of the juxtaposition of the way people feel about President Trump's agenda, some of the big items in President Trump's agenda, and the way they feel about him. So this is our first Marquette poll since the one that came out just before the election, which, like other polls, missed that Donald Trump was about to win Wisconsin and become president. But that last Marquette poll back in October showed that he had, a relatively low approval rating. He was 33% approved of him or had a favorable view of him compared to 62% who viewed him unfavorably. We've had a kind of a tumultuous few months. A lot of controversial stuff has come out since Donald Trump has been president, but his favorability rating has gone up since he's become president, 42% favorability versus 48% unfavorability. Big part of that is that he has become embraced by Wisconsin Republicans, who we remember last year there was a lot of lukewarm feelings, I guess, to put it mildly, among Wisconsin Republicans about whether they're going to embrace Trump. You look at that last Marquette poll, again, before he was elected, 67% of Wisconsin Republicans in late October viewed him favorably. That's up to 90% now. 90% of Wisconsin Republicans view Donald Trump favorably. So they've come around on him, and that's what's driving the bump in his approval ratings.
And Charles Franklin talked about that in this poll release, what happened between that last poll before the election and the election. And it sounded like, well, one, more 2-1 undecided voters went for Trump over Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of the Wow County, the suburban Milwaukee County conservative Republican strongholds, finally said, okay, we're not never Trump. When push comes to shove, we're going to vote for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, they had consistently said that he wasn't going to do as well as your typical Republican in Southeast Wisconsin, and he didn't. But he did a lot better than the polls were showing. That's where turnout was much better for Trump compared to the Marquette models. And I think the other thing you look at, as you look back at those polls, you realize there was this block of undecided voters that was showing up in those polls that maybe weren't getting the attention that they deserved. I think definitely weren't getting the attention they deserved given the way we now know everything went.
And we have heard a lot, of course, about political polarization in Wisconsin and around the country. How does that play out in these polls?
Well, I think the Democratic opinions of Donald Trump have not really changed. They're more like 90% the other direction. And so now you just have Republicans playing the other side of that, where before they were a little iffy when it came to Donald Trump. Now they are, despite their misgivings a year ago, 90% favor him. So that is definitely the polarized Wisconsin that I think we've gotten used to.
Hey, how about health care in that poll?
How about health care? That bill that's not going to be around anymore, at least in this form. People did not favor an outright repeal of the Affordable Care Act. In fact, if you call it the Affordable Care Act, they like it a lot better than if you call it just Obamacare. Putting affordable in front of something apparently is a good thing.
Or taking Obama out of it? I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. So that was one where 54% said they'd keep the Affordable Care Act, and only 36% would favor some sort of repeal. You're just looking at some other issues that Donald Trump has championed. 66% say undocumented immigrants currently working in the U.S. should stay. And only 37% support building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. 59% oppose that.
All right. Well, we'll be watching these polls and more in the weeks to come. Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief. He joined us to look at the top news from the past week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest on what's happening with the vote and now non-vote on the GOP's revised health care bill. First, the Public Religion Research Institute asked Americans which group faces a lot of discrimination, Muslims or Christians. The responses varied a lot from one group to another, but overall, a majority of Americans were more likely to say that Muslims face discrimination. Catholics, mainline Protestants, and religiously unaffiliated Americans were all roughly twice as likely to say Muslims face discrimination. But one group stood out, white evangelicals. More than half of them said they perceived a lot of discrimination against Christians. Fewer said Muslims. So what does that mean for the way religious groups see themselves and others? Robert P. Jones joins us now. He's CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, the group behind that survey. He's also the author of the book, The End of White Christian America. Robbie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, flesh those numbers out for us a little. How different are white evangelicals when they talk about who's being discriminated against here in America?
Yeah, well, you know, they are really in a category all by themselves, really, is the best way to put it. You know, even if we look at Republicans, you know, Republicans, when I actually looked at those numbers before I looked at the religious breaks, and there, actually, Republicans are just as likely to say that Christians and Muslims face a lot of discrimination. So that is, on the face of it, maybe a little bit surprising in itself. But then when we looked at the religious breaks, we noticed, you know, this number that, you know, nearly 6 in 10 white evangelical Protestants say that Christians face a lot of discrimination in the country, and only 44% say that about Muslims. And that's actually in a battery of 7 groups that we asked about. So we asked about gay and lesbian people, transgender people, immigrants, African-Americans, Muslims, whites, and Christians. And out of all of those groups, actually, white evangelicals say Christians face far more discrimination than any of those other groups that I just mentioned.
So why is that? They're unique compared to all the other groups you talk to.
Yeah, you know, I think part of it is that evangelicals are going through a real transition time right now. You know, they have come from the heady days of the Christian right, where they were really at the center of politics and really at the center of American culture. You know, we had the moral majority back in the 80s and 90s, and there was a kernel of truth to that, you know, on some flagship issues, for example, like gay marriage. You know, in the 90s, if you had sort of asked, you know, where is the general public? Are they with the Christian right on this issue? The answer to that would have been yes. But that's really no longer true, and that's mostly just changed in the last decade. So I would say two things have put them a bit on the defensive. One is the key shift on these kind of bellwether issues that we've gone, for example, just from the beginning of President Obama's tenure in 2008, only 4 in 10 Americans supported same-sex marriage. Our last numbers have that number at 63. Percent support. So just in the last 10 years, we've gone from basically 4 in 10 for supporting same-sex marriage to 4 in 10 opposing same-sex marriage. The number's been turned on its head. And then the other one that I think is really important for understanding this kind of persecution mentality that I think many, particularly white evangelicals, have is that the country actually has passed across the tipping point that I talk about, you know, in my book, that we've moved from being a majority white Christian country to a minority white Christian country, demographically speaking. So across that same period of time, we've gone from a country that was 54% white and Christian in 2008. Our latest numbers have that number down at 43%, so a drop of 11 percentage points over the last decade. And most importantly, that we really have crossed, you know, reached this tipping point and passed it. And I think it's those two factors, kind of the shifts in culture, the shifts in demographics, that I think have evangelicals feeling on the defensive and, you know, like the rest of the country is moving to a different place than they are.
We'll get back to that point, but I wanted to ask, do different groups have different perceptions of what discrimination means? I mean, sometimes you might say, okay, who's more subject to hate crimes or overt housing or employment discrimination on the one hand, or you could think of it as values that I have that were once at the center of American culture, as you were saying, are slipping away. My values are being ignored more and more. And if I'm in that position, I feel that that's a discrimination against me.
Right. So, you know, the question, you know, is a perception question, right? So we're not actually measuring, you know, we're presenting this with, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center's, you know, hate crime statistics, which certainly show those numbers have been up among many of these minority groups in the last over the last year. But, you know, well, here's another clue to it, I think. I think it is a kind of relative to other groups from their point of view. And so we asked another question that I think gets to the heart of it, and that is this a question that's really asking about quote-unquote reverse discrimination. And we asked, do you agree or disagree that today discrimination against whites has become as big a problem as discrimination against blacks and other minorities? And 63% of white evangelicals say that they agree with that statement as well. So I think it's about race. It's also about religion. And it kind of those two things, I think, are packaged together for many white evangelical Christians.
Talking to Robbie Jones from the Public Religion Research Institute, author of the book The End of White Christian America, about recent surveys they've done about our perceptions of religious discrimination in the United States. And Robbie, you had a chart at the Public Religion Research Institute that I thought was very striking, taking a cross-section of today and looking at generations and how white Christians compare to other groups and just striking changes from one generation to the next. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, if you just look at the generations that are, you know, alive today, and you don't have to look at any, you know, 40-year trend line. You can just look at the generations who are alive today. And what's striking, if you look at the percentage of each generation that identifies as white and Christian, you can really see this tectonic change, you know, right before our eyes. So if you look at seniors, about 2/3 of seniors identify as white and Christian. The number for younger Americans under the age of 30 is just a little more than 1 in 5. It's like 22-23%.
So 60% for the seniors, 20-23% for millennials, we can say, identify as white and Christian.
Right. So it's a factor of 3, right, that has shifted. And the generations in between look, you know, they're like stair steps. It's a linear stair step pattern in this generational chart. And so it really is just, you know, very linear step down that the younger the generation is, the fewer white Christians there are in that generation.
So a group of Americans who feel like their values are starting to be ignored, that people are walking away from their point of view, their cultural background. That sounds like some stories we were hearing about the 2016 elections. How did all this play out in politics?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you know, there's been kind of the great debate, you know, so was it economics, was it culture? And of course, the answer is yes, you know, to that question. But on the cultural side and this cultural anxiety, I mean, what I had argued that I actually saw happening as early as the South Carolina primary, which was the first kind of heavily Southern Republican primary, where there were 3/4 of the electorate in that election were white evangelical Protestants. And we still had, you know, we had Rick Santorum still in the race. We had Huckabee still in the race. We had Rubio still in the race. Many people who had a lot of bona fides in the evangelical community. And, of course, we had Donald Trump, and he handily won that. And he also went on Super Tuesday to win all the southern states with their large white evangelical populations. Here's what I think happened. And what I've argued is that what Donald Trump has succeeded in doing was tapping this larger anxiety, I think, about cultural and demographic change in the country. And he essentially succeeded in converting what had been, you know, self-described and self-understood values voters, and he converted them into what I had described as nostalgia voters. So that what became more important was not that the candidate had a certain kind of character or moral values that represented their values, but a candidate that they perceived could deliver the goods, and they were willing to kind of jump over, I think, the particular values and character questions on the candidate. One just quick evidence of that is, you know, we asked a question directly on a candidate's character in both 2011 and 2016. And we asked, you know, can a political candidate who's committed immoral acts in their personal life still carry out their duties and behave ethically in their public life? In 2011, white evangelical Protestants were the least likely group in the country to agree that that was possible. Only 30% of them said that was possible. When we got in 2016, we asked this question again, 72% of white evangelicals said that this was possible. So they went actually from the least likely group to say that this was possible and that character, you know, is really everything, to the most likely group to say that this was possible, and essentially that character wasn't the most important thing, and that, you know, you could still behave ethically regardless of what you did in your personal moral life.
I wanted to ask about changes in Protestant Christianity in the United States. We'd seen a trend in the past where kind of the older school denominations were seeing declines. The newer evangelical so-called mega churches were growing. Is that still what's going on?
Right. No, this is a great question. You know, it's right that what we really the heyday of particularly white Protestant churches were really the 50s and the 60s. That's where, you know, we saw this post-World War II boom that really held on into the 60s. Churches were bursting at the seams. New churches were getting started everywhere. And then we began to see a first wave of decline really in the 70s through the end of the 20th century, 70s, 80s, and 90s, among the mainline Protestant denominations. So Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Methodists, and the like. And they tend to be the more kind of liberal end of the white Protestant world. And that was a real wave, big declines that's now sort of stabilized a bit. And during that time, it really was white evangelicals were starting these big mega churches. It looked like there were a lot of academic articles written that said, you know, why strict churches are growing, for example. And it looked like conservative Christianity was going to, you know, sort of win the day. Over the last 10 years, though, what we found is actually that we're seeing a second wave of white Christian decline that has really encompassed the more conservative end of the churches. So the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, the largest of the white evangelical denominations, has lost over 1 million members over the last 10 years, has now posted 9 straight years of membership losses. And even at the national level, you can measure about a 20% decline relative to other groups over the last decade.
Very briefly, Robbie, we're just about out of time.
Sure.
What is your next question that you want answered?
You know, I think the real question, you know, is where are all these people going, right? And they're going to this big category that we have this kind of default category called the religiously unaffiliated that now make up a quarter of Americans. They're heavily young. Most of the attrition from these white churches have gone into that category. They've gone nowhere. They've gone to being not affiliated with any religion. And the real question is, you know, when are they going to have an impact? We've been talking about elections at the ballot box, because unlike white Christians who tend to vote, turn out and vote at high levels, they make up a quarter of Americans, but only 12% of voters. And if that ever shifts, it will absolutely transform our national politics.
Robbie, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
It's Robert P. Jones with the Public Religion Research Institute, author of the book The End of White Christian America. Coming up, a look at today's non-vote on the Republican health care bill. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold joins the show. He says Democrats need to get over the election results and move forward, and he talks about his new effort to combat the influence of money in politics. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, House Republican leaders have pulled the American Health Care Act after failing to secure enough votes to see it pass on the House floor. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan talking to reporters about that decision.
I will not sugarcoat this. This is a disappointing day for us. Doing big things is hard. All of us, myself included, we will need time to reflect on how we got to this moment, what we could have done to do it better. But ultimately, this all kind of comes down to a choice. Are all of us willing to give a little to get something done?
This bill was the GOP's answer to repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The failure to reach a consensus among the GOP after a lot of lobbying by Paul Ryan, Vice President Pence, and even President Trump could spell trouble for other reforms many lawmakers ran on in the last election. We're going to take your calls in just a little bit. What do you think about the failure of the vote today? What do you think about the Republican effort to replace the Affordable Care Act? What do you think is next? What do you want to see happen next for health care in the United States? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Amy Goldstein joins us now, healthcare reporter for the Washington Post. She's been covering this debate for a while now. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
You focused a lot on policy throughout this. What were the policy sticking points between Paul Ryan and Republicans, the conservative group on one side and the more moderate Republicans on the other?
Well, you're framing the question right, because this was basically a dramatic inability of Republicans to figure out how to get along with one another. This was not a disagreement between the Republicans and the Democrats in the House of Representatives. And, you know, somebody this week described it, the problem to me, as an analogizing to a water balloon, where if you push on one side, the other side pokes out and vice versa. So that's kind of a way of thinking about the problem. And specifically, the biggest group of House members who were objecting to this, rebelling against this legislation, were from a very conservative faction called the House Freedom Caucus. And, you know, basically, they wanted to have the healthcare system of this country much more a free market system than even this pretty conservative bill would have done.
And then on the other end of that water balloon, how about the Republicans who are worried if it passed about impacts on their own constituents?
Well, that's right. I mean, that was on the other side, as you point out. So there was a smaller group of moderate Republicans in the House Republican Conference who were particularly concerned about how the legislation would have changed Medicaid. Medicaid was expanded under the Affordable Care Act, and that's obviously the 2010 law that the Republicans have been trying to rewrite or replace. And within a couple of years under the House legislation, money that has gone to states to pay for almost all the costs of expanding who is eligible for Medicaid would have started to go away. So there are 16 Republican governors, including yours, in states that have expanded Medicaid. And some of the House members from those states were particularly concerned about the loss of money and the effects on people who are low income and relying on Medicaid.
One of the trickiest things to square here, I've heard from policy analysts in the past, as I understand it anyway, the last version I was looking at, this legislation would have kept the pre-existing condition requirement, saying you can't refuse coverage for pre-existing conditions, but it would have gotten rid of the health care mandate. And a lot of analysts said you can't have one without the other. The pre-existing conditions thing raises costs for insurance companies. The mandate helps balance the risk and costs. It's really hard to square that. Is that part of the tension here?
Well, let me say a couple things about the point that you're raising. There are some popular parts of the Affordable Care Act. One is a rule that insurers cannot charge more to or refuse to cover people with pre-existing medical problems. That's a very popular part of the ACA. Republicans have wanted to keep that. They've also wanted to keep another popular part of the law, which is let young adults stay on their parents' insurance policies until they reach the age of 26. So, you know, public polling has just over and over shown that American people like those parts of the law. Republicans did not want to get rid of them. Now, on the other hand, they didn't exactly in this bill say that they were going to get rid of the mandate. What they were going to get rid of was the financial penalty, the tax penalty that the law has had for people who don't live up to the requirement that most Americans have insurance. So that's what the law would have gotten rid of. But your point is that these two things are somewhat in tension. The insurance industry, which obviously has a big stake in how this all plays out because it's their customers and their finances, they've said all along that in order for the marketplaces created by the ACA to work, you need to have a good enough mix of healthy and unhealthy customers. You need to have a good enough mix, in other words, of younger people and older people. And there haven't been enough younger people getting insurance under the current law. And the fear is that if the rules no longer compel people to have insurance, it's likely to be the healthy people who say, well, I don't need to do this anymore. So that's the problem.
Talking to Amy Goldstein, health reporter for The Washington Post, about today's cancellation of the vote on the American Health Care Act, the repeal and replace effort for Obamacare. Amy, let's take a couple minutes to look ahead now. Obamacare, as we've heard, continues to be the law of the land. There have been issues, rising premiums. Republicans made a lot of that on the campaign trail. What's next?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? And that's actually a story that I'm right on deadline working on today while you and I are talking. So it seems that the Trump administration now faces a big choice. Are they going to try to do a series of things that would help cure, help improve the marketplaces so that they're more stable, so that the premiums don't keep going up? Are they going to try to encourage people to keep joining them? So as we were just talking about a moment ago, there's a nice mix of customers for these health insurers. Or are they just going to say, you know, this isn't a law that we like. We're just going to let it fall apart. I mean, that's a big choice that this new administration faces. And it's not yet clear what's going to happen. But just a couple of hours ago, the president actually called one of my Washington Post colleagues, Bob Costa, to tell him that this bill was being withdrawn. It's kind of an interesting phone call. And during that, what turned into an interview, the president told my Post colleague that, you know, politically, we should just let this Affordable Care Act explode. I mean, whether that's going to happen down the road is very hard to say. But those are the choices that the administration faces, and that's what the president was saying this afternoon.
So wide open now, it sounds like. Amy, I will let you go and hit that deadline. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Glad to talk with you.
That's Amy Goldstein, health reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us to give us the latest on the GOP's revised health care bill, which did not come to a scheduled vote today. It's off the table. Lots of question marks now. And speaking of question marks, I have a question for you. What do you think of what happened today? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to see this non-vote today? Or were you hoping that Republicans would pass the American Health Care Act? What do you want to see happen? Should we try to fix as best we can the Affordable Care Act? Do you want something completely different? What do you think should happen? What do you think will happen? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Your call's coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this afternoon, House Republican leaders pulled their long-promised health care bill aimed at replacing the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, pulled after Republicans couldn't secure enough votes for it to pass on the House floor. House Speaker Paul Ryan told reporters this afternoon that the Affordable Care Act could remain the law of the land for the foreseeable future. Democratic leaders made the case that Republicans should work with them on amending the Affordable Care Act. Want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen with American health care now? What do you want to see from Congress, from the president, maybe at the state level? How does this affect you? Have you gotten coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace? Were you worried about Medicare, Medicaid? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to our callers. Katie is with us in Janesville. Katie, hi.
Hi. My suggestion would be, can we do something along the lines of just a basic Medicaid for everybody? The Republicans would come out looking really good by covering everybody in the nation, but have it very, very pared back, just a basic coverage. And then if we want more coverage, if you want more for catastrophic, if you want more hospitalization, if you want more medical care, we can let the free market work to buy in more coverage as each family or each individual would see fit.
Katie, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Actually, I added a confidant of President Trump, Christopher Ruddy, I think his name is, from Newsmax, had said something along those lines. Maybe it's we do need universal care. Mary Jo is with us next in Racine. Mary Jo, hi.
Hi. I was going to say that I disagree with the mandate. I know that was invented when Mitt Romney was in Massachusetts. I don't think Americans should be forced to patronize any corporation. And ultimately, what we need, like the previous caller was saying, we don't need insurance. We need doctors, nurses, medicine. The insurance industry is the problem, in my opinion.
Mary Jo, thanks a lot for that call. We're taking your calls on the Affordable Care Act, the now not going to happen, apparently, American Health Care Act. No vote in the House today. Getting your reactions at 800-642-1234. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi reacted to this, other Democrats, too. Here's a listen to what she had to say. She said bipartisanship wasn't the major factor in why the bill failed.
Right now, quite frankly, the reason that they lost was because of actions they took or did not take, but it's also because the American people weighed in. Our phone lines were all deluged. I want to thank all the people who expressed themselves to members of Congress, either say thank you for supporting the Affordable Care Act or kill the bill, you know, whoever they were calling. So let's just for a moment breathe a sigh of relief for the American people that the Affordable Care Act was not repealed, which was their goal on the 7th anniversary.
Nancy Pelosi there. Let's go back to your calls now with Bob in Stevens Point. Bob, hi.
Hi. I think that judging from the past interview you had, I agree with the premise of just let the bill cave in on itself, let the Affordable Care Act cave in on itself financially. And then I think it'll actually give the president some leverage. It'll also be a motivator for the Democrats, and we can come out of this with a bipartisan bill. But the only way you're going to be able to force that issue is, you know, is to get to the fine, you know, to the absolute last line of defense here. And that's what it's going to come down to. It'll come down to the money, the availability of the money to keep funding the program. And once it comes to that, then they'll be willing to act.
Bob, thanks a lot for calling. I wanted to ask, I mean, bipartisanship, sometimes it's few and far between. Do you think even if we're in a crisis with the ACA in the future, that bipartisanship could actually happen?
You know, I used to frame myself as a bit of an idealist and a romantic and always thought that, you know, at the end of the day, they'd put their differences aside and work together. And I think it's a fair question that you bring up because after, you know, the contentious debate and the fact that the Affordable Care Act 7 years ago, the way that went down, I would like to think that I think that the president wants to work with the Democrats. This is a different kind of a president. I think we can all agree on that. So I think that the at least there's a flicker of hope that can be worked out. I really, honestly, in my heart, I believe that. Do I think that's going to meet reality? I doubt it.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Let's actually give a listen to President Trump. He spoke to the reporters in the Oval Office following the announcement that the American Health Care Act would be pulled from the House floor. Here's what he had to say.
Well, I think we could have things that I would have liked more. And if we had bipartisan, I really think we could have a health care bill that would be the ultimate. And I think the Democrats know that also. And someday in the not too distant future, that'll happen. And I never said, I guess I'm here, what, 64 days? I never said repeal and replace Obamacare. You've all heard my speeches. I never said repeal it and replace it within 64 days. I have a long time. But I want to have a great health care bill and plan, and we will. It will happen, and it won't be in the very distant future.
We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 on health care, past and future. No vote today in the House. It looks like the American Health Care Act, the repeal and replace bill, isn't happening. Definitely not today. We'll go to our callers now, Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, hi.
Hi. I'm very glad it went down in flames. And I'm just wondering if maybe in the future the single payer, or like Bernie Sanders used to say, Medicare for all. And I also thought of a saying that, and by the way, I really agree with those two ladies before that called in. They were just great what they said. And what I heard this quotation some years ago, and it said, you can always count on America to do the right thing after it's tried everything else.
Jocelyn, and that said, I want to ask you, I mean, Democrats, when they had their crack at this, they set aside that single payer idea really fast. Do you think that, I mean, if the Democrats are going to pass it, is it going to happen anytime?
Yeah. That I don't know if it's ever going to. I don't. That really upset me when that happened because I don't know why that happened. And the only way I can think of is insurance companies. You know, they have deep pockets and the lobbyists and all that. And the main thing that most of those Congress people are worried about is getting reelected. So when you have that kind of mindset, how the heck can you pass anything? They're not like this bill that just went down. It wasn't for anybody that was really in need. And then they were going to give a break to the billionaires again. I mean, what else can you think when he's surrounded by billionaires? And he, I mean, how many billionaires do you know that really go in for charity or whatever you want to call it? You know, it's just astounding to me how they just, if they would just think of the country as a whole and not getting reelected all the time.
Jocelyn, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Polly in Round Lake Beach. Polly, hi.
Hi. I got to say, I agree with Bob and Jocelyn. They both make a lot of sense. I feel, you know, that both the parties have been jabbering back and forth at each other. And there's things that haven't even been looked into or brought up. I mentioned it, one of them, with the lady who answered the phone. Germany, Japan, they both have nonprofit insurance companies that people can turn to and the government to help if they can't afford anything. And they are not third world countries or anything. They have, you know, sort of the same ideas about how people should be taken care of, and I think we have a lot to look into, and like they said, people had a lot of time to look into it before they got in office, and I think they ought to work together.
Polly, thanks a lot for that call. We are taking your calls on health care in the United States. After the anticipated vote on the American Health Care Act, the Republican repeal and replace bill was canceled today in the U.S. House. Big question marks in the future. Back to your calls. Jane with us in Minocqua. Jane, hi.
Hi. Two things. The first thing is that this isn't a Republican or a Democrat issue. It's a American issue. We need good health care in America. But the Republicans won't drop the fight against the Democrats. Even today they said, this is the second thing, that it was the Democrats' fault that this whole thing failed, when they've been touting the fact that the Senate and the House are both a majority of Republicans. So if they're a majority, how can they blame the Democrats for the failure?
Jane, thanks a lot for your call, too. By the way, if you're fighting a full phone line, you could also share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go next to John on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm looking forward to Trump's threat to potentially get representatives out of office if it was a threat. I mean, you have the option of a Democrat getting in there, or if it's an extreme Republican, you get an opportunity to see what they're really like and potentially know if that's your thing. I'm imagining it's not most people's thing.
John, yeah, the president had said something about that. People said, oh, it was a joke, maybe not a threat. You're not sure how to read that?
No, I'm not. I'm never sure what he's exactly meaning. If he means that he's going to help people get out of office, or if he means that he's just hoping to see that.
Got it. John, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Darlene with us in Tomahawk. Hi, Darlene.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First off, the ACA originally said that there's going to be no maximum coverage, so a lifetime coverage. My husband had cancer, and 15 months he went through, we spent $750,000 just for that. Of course, he passed away, though. But, I mean, they mentioned the 26-year-olds that can stay on the insurance and pre-existing, but there was also a no limit. That's not mentioned very much now anymore.
Darlene, I'm sorry for your loss. That made a big difference for you, that no limit?
Well, no. He was on his company insurance at that time. But then also, when it seems to me, I remember Obama, when this first began, and maybe at a press conference, he said he knows it's not perfect, but he expected that somewhere down the line they were going to be tweaking it. You know, whether it be the Democrats or the Republicans, that would be tweakable. Why hasn't the Democrats done any tweaking on it?
Darlene, thanks so much for your call. Again, sorry for your loss. Thanks for all of your calls, by the way. You could keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. The story is to be continued. What do you want to see happen next when it comes to healthcare policy in the United States and here at home in Wisconsin? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.